The final argument this morning is Kasubi versus Dakota Logging and Triple R Construction. For the appellant, Estes Brothers is Stephen Morgan's, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, Triple R Construction is Lisa Hansen-Marceau, an attorney from Sioux Falls. For appellee Kasubi is Mr. Rodney Lefholtz, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee Kurtz Construction and American State Insurance is Mr. Scott Summer, an attorney from Rapid City. Now, it's the court's understanding, as far as the appellees, that Ms. Marceau will go first for 11 minutes, then Mr. Lefholtz will go second for 7 minutes, and then Mr. Summer will go third and has 2 minutes.
Correct.
Very well. The court should also note that Justices Sabres and Konenkamp have disqualified themselves, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller to sit in one seat as on this case, and also has appointed the Honorable William J. Sirska Jr., a circuit judge from Sioux Falls, to sit in the other vacancy. With that, Mr. Morgans, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Morgans. I represent the appellant, Estes Brothers, and the employer Estes Brothers, and the insurer, Cigna Property and Casualty. And just for the record, it's probably not a big deal, but I'm actually from Sioux Falls. I used to practice in Rapid City, my initial 4 years of practice, but I'm in Sioux Falls now with Lynn Jackson, Schultz, and Brunn. We're here today regarding claimant Harlan Kasubi's workers' compensation claims that have gone over a course of history since as far back as 1986 and bring us up to 1998. The medical history and the treatment and the injuries can be somewhat complicated in this case because it is a long history and it's an unfortunate history. But what I'll start is just briefly summarize the 6 discrete injuries that we have identified in this case, starting with the 1986 injury with Dakota Logging, where Mr. Kasubi was struck on the head by a log that fell on his helmet when he was doing some logging. Dakota Logging was the employer for that one. They are not a party to this action. The second work injury was in 1990 with my employer, Estes Brothers, which involved a trip and fall on the roof where claimant fell kind of on his neck and back and shoulder. Then in 1993, while employed with Dean Kurtz, and I should back up, while he was employed with Estes Brothers, he was essentially a laborer, concrete form finisher, and that's kind of the occupational history he had from about 1990 through 1998 when he had his last injury. But in 1993, with Dean Kurtz, Kasubi had an injury when he was tying rebar and injured it was described as his rib popping out, but the medical records reflect that he had thoracic middle of back problems that he treated with Dr. Gruba. The second discrete injury with Dean Kurtz Construction involved a fall in snow in January of 1994. This one, I don't believe there's any notice of injury in the record for this fall, but it was reflected he went to the chiropractor the next day. That brings it up to 1998. He's now working for Triple R Construction, and in the fall of 1998, I believe it was September 15th, he had his first discrete low back injury where he was off work for a little time. He went back to work. Then on November 22nd, 1998, bringing us up to the time where he left work completely, he had another injury to his low back, where after that date, he never works again. Now, I believe that the timeline as it relates to my employer, Estes Brothers, is fairly straightforward. After his incident in 1990, he never misses any work. He goes through a series of chiropractic treatment in 1990 and 1991. I think there's approximately 24 appointments during that time frame. and they were for various symptoms, upper back, neck. There's no mention of any shoulder injuries at that time. Then in 1992, Mr. Kasubi has one chiropractic appointment with the same chiropractor, whose name is Dr. Gruba, who was, his only physician between 1990 and 1994. Then there's an 11-month gap in treatment, and Mr. Kasubi does not treat again, and then again until 1993, he starts treating for, when he first goes back in 1993 with Dr. Gruba, he's talking about low back injuries, which I think by all accounts was not pointed at our fall in 1990. The summary of it is he goes forward through from 1990, and I should have mentioned that he left employment with Estes Brothers about a month or two after he had this fall, never miss any time. He leaves work for no reason that's related to the injuries, and then he goes to work for Dean Kurtz Construction. He works essentially for 8 more years in this industry until that 1998, that last 1998 injury where he injured his low back, and after that injury, Mr. Kasubi has never worked again. The Department of Labor has found him to be permanently and totally disabled, which was affirmed by the circuit court as of that last date on November 22nd, 1998. My primary focus in my arguments today will be on the decision of the Department of Labor and then affirmed by the circuit court to apportion under SDCL 62-4-29 the respective liabilities of the permanent and total disability award, that where the Department of Labor found that 2/3 of the award was allocated to my employer, Estes Brothers, as a result of the 1990 injury, and 1/3 was allocated to Triple R Construction for the low back injury in 1998. The other secondary focus that I will spend some time talking about is the treatment for Mr. Kasubi's left shoulder. He had a surgery in 1996, and I want to spend some time talking about that as well, because the Department of Labor also found that not only was my employer, Estes Brothers, responsible for all treatment related to the neck and upper back, but also the left shoulder. And as I briefly identified in the timeline, when Mr. Kasubi treated in those initial years, he did not, there was no record or reference to any left shoulder problems.
Just so I'm clear, the second issue, the shoulder issue, really doesn't, the outcome of that issue isn't dependent upon this apportionment statute, is it?
No.
That's a factual issue.
Right, okay. That's correct. And that really just relates to payment of discrete medical records. It is Estes Brothers' position that the Department of Labor was in error in deciding to apportion the benefits in this case under SDCL 62-4-29. I say that because South Dakota, this court has, in the case of Novak v. Grossenberg, adopted the what's called in South Dakota the last injurious exposure rule. In other jurisdictions, some jurisdictions refer to it as the full responsibility rule, but essentially it means that if you've got consecutive injuries, you have some slight contribution from the subsequent employment, they pick up the whole injury or all the results. You kind of take the claimant as you find them. In that Novak case, the South Dakota Supreme Court expressly rejected apportionment and identified the inherent problems in apportioning. When you look at SDCL 62-4-29, while it talks about apportionment, it has apportionment in there, it can be somewhat misleading because it doesn't mean that South Dakota has adopted apportionment. What it has done is it has a statute that allows apportionment or credit in very limited circumstances. What that statute requires is that the claimant must be disabled and drawing compensation at the time of the subsequent injury before apportionment will kick in. That holding, or that statutory rule, was reinforced by this court's decision in Kubel. where it said the plain meaning of the statute requires that the claimant must be drawing compensation at the time of the second injury. In this case, there's no evidence on the record, and there's just no facts to establish that claimant was receiving benefits at the time of his November 22nd, 1998 injury with Triple R Construction.
How did the hearing officer handle that issue? Since he was not drawing benefits, how was it addressed?
To my best recollection, Your Honor, I believe that the Department of Labor essentially said that
it's in finding the fact that 21, I think it is. It says, because claimant's compensation rate was fixed on the date of injury, each employer shall pay its share of the permanent total disability benefit at the compensation rate determined by its respective date of injury. Were you there at the, or did you represent the your party at this hearing?
Yes. I take that back. There's two underlying hearings.
Okay.
It was bifurcated. I was at the first one. I had another attorney from our office.
I think that's the finding of fact.
So the hearing officer really never made a decision as far as whether or not he was drawing benefits at that time.
No, I don't think the hearing officer just made any specific distinction of the Kubel decision.
Mm-hmm.
I think
what about the XL case? Yeah, from Iowa, did the hearing examiner rely on that? Is that how he?
No, to my best recollection, and Constable Triple R can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe that the Smithart decision was discussed in the briefs leading up to the Department of Labor's decision. So the decision came down, and so that was more of an argument presented in support of the Department of Labor's decision.
What's clearly erroneous about that particular finding? That it was fixed.
That the compensation was...
It says the compensation rate was fixed on the date of the injury, which, what is it, in your opinion, wrong with that?
I think when you have to look at that finding in light of the legal precedent of SDCL 62-429 that indicates you must be disabled and drawing compensation at the time of the injury. So I think that that's a legal determination that is erroneous and a wrong application of that.
Is there some policy decision behind that that would support your argument that the legislature may have been looking at when they passed these two statutes, the one apportionment and then?
Kind of taking a step back. In this case, as you are all aware, workers' compensation does take into account a lot of policy decisions. In every state, you can go to 50 different jurisdictions. Everyone has different piecemeal application. In South Dakota, this apportionment statute, for lack of a better term, was enacted in 1817. And other than the Kubel decision, which clarified what it was required, there is no other clarification for the basis of it. To me, the best way to understand the background, and Justice Sinter referenced the Smithart case, and I identified in my briefs some of the case authority in Iowa, which has a very similar statute that allows this apportionment under limited circumstances. When you look at the rationale behind what Iowa has done and applying that same statute, what they're trying to avoid, they're not so worried about apportionment versus shifting the responsibility on their full responsibility rule. What they're worried about is you got a worker that's, for instance, in this case, let's take Mr. Kasubi, for example. If he, after he had his surgeries in 1996, let's say he goes back to work part-time and is receiving temporary partial disability benefits. So he's receiving a set amount of benefits, yet he's working. Okay, now he has a subsequent injury that takes him out of work completely. Well, under the second injury, you could say, well, I get per total benefits because it's 100% total disability, but his previous benefits have not run yet. So the key in the Iowa case is that they talk about working units, that you're one working unit, and they try to, it's an attempt to avoid double recovery. So you can't have overlap of benefit periods where the claimant will be receiving 150% of benefits. So when I talk about it loosely as an apportionment statute, I don't think South Dakota has ever adopted apportionment other than allowing this offset or credit or overlap so that claimant under those particular circumstances does not receive extra benefits.
You know, is it possible though that since the apportionment statute's been on the books since 1917, that perhaps in 1975, when the court considered Novak, that it overlooked or wasn't presented, or for whatever reason, just didn't get that issue before them at the time, because they expressly said, acknowledged that some states, you know, apportion by statute. Here we've got an apportionment statute, and Novak doesn't even reference the statute.
Well, and I guess, you know, and we don't know, and that's a good question, Your Honor. But I think the presumption is that in that case, you didn't have those key criteria that the claimant was disabled and drawing compensation at the time of the second injury. So it presumably was not addressed at that time. If it didn't have that, if that statute took out those two key phrases, yes, we would have a regular apportionment statute, and you'd say, okay, we do have to apply that. But with that, you got to say, what do those terms, disabled and drawing compensation, mean? It's got to have some significance, and I think the best explanation, as I indicated earlier, is the rationale provided by the Iowa case is saying you can't have that overlap or additional credit.
Well, in South Dakota, tell us before you run out of time, how can we interpret both of these statutes to make them both work harmoniously with each other, that being the successive injury statute and the apportionment statute?
Well, I think when you look at the statutory scheme that it essentially adopts the last injurious exposure rule when you have consecutive injuries, from my perspective, that applies whenever you have a case. I mean, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. The only time that it's cut out of that full responsibility rule, because, I mean, you could think of all the policy issues, and Justice Meyer-Henry, you addressed that, of the differences between apportionment and full responsibility, but I think the court did indicate a preference for the full responsibility because of the apportionment. And for example, when you have the full responsibility rule, the question is there some independent contribution from the subsequent event? Typically, in most cases, that's either is clear cut. Sometimes there is some slight, sometimes there's not. But if it's a significant contribution, it's taken care of, and it's not it's easily litigated. However, if you apportion, and in this case would be a perfect example, we'd be addressing percentages from four or five different employers, potentially, because even the Department of Labor talks about some of the other injuries as well, although in the findings they primarily focus on the low back and the neck. If I could take a moment, I think I have 3 minutes left, to just talk about the secondary issue of the shoulder injury. As I indicated, we've been allocated, Estes Brothers has been allocated full responsibility for payment of medical expenses related to the left shoulder. Dr. Gruber was the only treating physician between 1990 and 1994 for Mr. Kasubi. There was no, Dr. Gruber testified in this case that he did not, there was no record reflecting that he ever treated claimant for left shoulder problems in that time frame, and two, that he didn't recall treating claimant for left shoulder problems during that time frame. There's like 50 chiropractic records in between that time frame, 1990, 1994, and there's absolutely no reference to a left shoulder injury. Ironically enough, the day we first see a reference to a left shoulder problems is on, I believe, January 15th, 1994. And in the notes, it references a fall the day before at Dean Kurtz Construction. It's the first time that this is ever mentioned. And yet, the Department of Labor and the Circuit Court has affirmed that we're responsible for all that treatment. We don't believe that there's any competent medical evidence establishing either by claimant meeting his burden of showing the causation of the left shoulder condition attributing it to Estes Brothers, or otherwise that would indicate that that problem should be the responsibility of Estes Brothers, and we believe that's clear error on the record. There's two physicians that are referenced regarding the shoulder injury. One is Dr. Fromm, who performed the surgery. His statement was, in his records, state that other injuries could, or these injuries could easily have been caused by his originally working injury, is how he had it in his record. Well, as I don't think that that meets the requisite standard to establish that it was the 1990 fall when there's been no treatment in 4 years to say that it could have been caused by the original working injury. We don't know if that's even talking about the 1986 injury. The only other physician addressing that is Dr. Burt, who had performed an IME, and I think Dr. Burt's records are replete with errors. He was wrong on the call for surgery, and he relies upon claimant's history to say that I had continuous problems with left shoulder injuries through that time frame, which is contrary to the records.
Okay. Thank you, Counselor. Your time has expired. All right, Ms. Marcel, you have 11 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices, Judges. May it please the Court and Counsel, I am Lisa Marceau. I represent Triple R Construction in this case. And the issues involving Triple R Construction is whether or not Triple R should have to pay and be liable to pay any indemnity compensation where the claimant is not permanently totally disabled, in our opinion, and not met that standard, and where Estes Brothers' injury is the reason the claimant would not be able to work if the court determines he is permanently totally disabled. And what's significant in this case is what you have is two separate and distinct injuries. The claimant, by his own admission, has admitted that if he only had the neck injury, not the back injury, he couldn't work. He's admitted that if he just had the back injury, he could work. And so under these unique circumstances of this case, we believe Triple R Construction and its insurer should not be liable to pay any indemnity compensation. I want to specifically first address
the court's remaining. You know, if you had separate and distinct injuries to the exact same, say, disc in the back, it wouldn't make sense to apportion in that kind of a case, would it? Should we use that test, successive and distinct? Or let me ask it this way. Same question I asked Mr. Morgan. How can we make both of these concepts in statute? Because they both have some statutory origin. How can we apply both? What should be the rule when successive injury applies and when apportionment applies?
I think you can harmoniously work these statutes and rules together. And the way you do that is the last injurious exposure rule, by how it has been adopted in the court, specifically would apply where you have injury to the same area, the same disc in the lower back. It does not apply where you have distinct injuries to two different parts of the body. And that's what we have here.
Yeah, well, what if it's one disc away or two discs away? I mean, and you've got all these back cases, a lot of them. You've talked about degenerative diseases involved and other underlying things. I mean, it's pretty hard to separate some of these.
But then they would not be distinct, clear injuries. And the medical testimony in this case is they are very distinct and very clear injuries. It's not an injury to the L4-5, an injury to the S1-L5. It's very clearly distinct. And what the last injurious exposure rule requires is a prior episode, an aggravation recurrence to the prior episode. We don't have an aggravation recurrence to the prior episode. We have two distinct injuries. So when you're dealing with a matter in which you have two distinct injuries, that's when you would apply the apportionment, because the last injurious exposure rule can't apply where there's two distinct injuries. And that's very clearly spelled out in the last injurious exposure cases. Where you have apportionment to be applied then is either where there are two distinct injuries, in this case the neck and the back, or where you have an injury to the same area But you're drawing compensation, you're disabled, and there's testimony to support, medical testimony that is credible and supported by foundation to support what percentages would be appropriate. So I think you can make them all work so long as you either have apportionment to distinct injuries and the medical testimony support, or you have the same area, but you have the medical evidence support.
Sounds like we're creating a whole new minefield for workers' compensation litigation.
I don't think so, because I think what you're doing is you're saying, well, what is the medical testimony? In Novak, there was the same injury, the same area. You had no medical testimony to support any distinctions. But in this case, what you have is clear, distinct testimony on what percentages each area should be apportioned. Dr. Anderson's testimony supports that. Justice Meyerhan, your question on how did the trial court, the lower court, get to this issue of apportionment? Judge Bingner relied upon a Texas case, and when you look at the administrative record, 1246, that's his written decision. He decided apportionment applied. He relied upon the Texas case to say, where you have medical evidence assigning the percentages, you can apportion based upon the evidence that you have. That's how he got to it. Judge Gores looked at the Smithart case that was mentioned, and he said, that's how you go back to the drawing compensation. The statute, SDCL 62429, you are drawing compensation because of a couple different things. One, from 1990 to 1998 into 2000, Mr. Kasubi was receiving medical treatment, receiving medical benefits. He was drawing compensation under the title, as that phrase is used, because he was receiving those medical benefits. Even though there was a dispute, American States was paying for them at that time instead of Cigna and Estes Brothers. You have the medical benefits, and then you have this issue of retroactivity, which is what Judge Gores honed in on with respect to, if you have a claim that is going to be adjudicated, is being adjudicated, it goes back retroactive to the date of the last time he worked, and because it's retroactive, you're drawing compensation. So we meet the drawing compensation under the apportionment. We meet that he had a disability. He had problems since 1990. In 1990, all the way through, he was having injections, therapy, chiropractic treatments, two significant surgeries, more injections, medication. He was disabled. Being disabled is simply having a medical or mental condition that's affecting your activities of daily life. Clearly, at the time of his injury, he was disabled and was drawing compensation, as that term is defined with respect to medical benefits and retroactivity. Not only that, but it's interesting that SDCL 62429 doesn't say it's exclusive. It says when you're drawing compensation and you're disabled and you have different percentages that can be assigned, then the department shall apportion. I think this court, when you look at the Novak case, your question, Justice Zinter, I think you asked, was this ever looked at, this apportionment statute? Judge Woolman, in his dissent in that case, specifically said, we're not looking at the statute, and we need to look at the statute. But it didn't get to the forefront, I think, in that case, because you're dealing with the same body area, and you don't have any medical evidence to support a percentage of apportionment. This case, you have that medical evidence. The Novak court thought it might be too confusing, but there was no medical evidence, and it was dealing with the same body part. There's numerous cases that we've cited throughout the country that allow apportionment, and I think it's time to look at this Novak case apportionment, look at the statute that specifically allows for apportionment. We've met the criteria for it, and we also believe apportionment can be done when you have an injury that's progressive in nature, and by the time of a second injury, it's causing the disability. With respect to the last injurious exposure rule, what the lower courts decision and the Department of Labor's decision was you need the prior aggravation or recurrence of a prior episode. And not only that, the rule, just in general, places liability on the insurer carrying the risk for an injury bearing a causal relation to the final disability.
So the last employer then has the burden of proving that there should be contribution by a prior employer?
Actually, the burden of proof in the truck insurance case, paragraph 27 or 28, says it is the first employer who has the burden of proving that it should be displaced to the second. Estes Brother here has a burden of proving it should be displaced to Triple R. Estes Brothers has always carried the risk of the cervical condition getting worse and causing the disability. It's never not been on that risk. It's still on the risk for providing medical treatment. We don't have any injury from Triple R causing any injury to the neck. It's always on that risk. It continues to be on the risk. And its injury bears a causal relation to the final disability, not just disability, but when we look at the cases on last injurious exposure rule, it's final disability. The final disability here is that he's not working. And that is because of the neck condition. The testimony is, if he just had the lower back condition, he could work. He's admitted it, the vocational doctors admit it, all the medical experts admitted it. If he just had the lower back, he could work. And the testimony is, in and of itself, the cervical condition is causing the inability to work.
But there is evidence of independent contribution.
The evidence of
the low back, there's medical evidence in the record that the low back independently contributed to the final disability, quote unquote.
And that evidence comes from Dr. Carlson, who didn't have all the medical records, didn't read the medical depositions, would not answer questions about what was he doing at these employers, what was his work. Dr. Anderson, I think it's confused in the reply brief of Estes Brothers, Dr. Anderson clearly says 100% of the disability of not being able to work if he can't work is from Estes Brothers. The only contribution that the lower back has is for the need for any treatment, if any, for the lower back. He wasn't on medication at the time of the hearing. He wasn't needing medical treatment. His pain was maybe once every 6 weeks he'd have an episode, as opposed to being in disabling pain, as he claimed, seeing over 8 doctors, having surgeries, going to treatments well over 200 times in that period of 10 months.
Does this, if we were to rule as you are suggesting, does this place any additional burdens on the claimant in the hearing process or the coming forward with information?
The issue with respect to the claimant is the claimant has to show that the second incident materially contributed to. What we're dealing right now with Estes Brothers and Triple R is a dispute between employer and insurer, and that's something they have to come in, Estes Brothers, and show that we are an aggravation, not just a recurrence. So I don't think it places an additional burden on the claimant, because the claimant always is going to have to prove causation. With respect to the issue of the permanent total disability, we believe the evidence isn't substantial. To support that decision, we are requesting this court reverse and hold Triple R not liable for any indemnity benefits or affirm the one-third, two-thirds.
Thank you, Ms. Marcel. Mr. Leffoltz, you have 7 minutes, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices. May this please the court, counsel. My name is Rod Leffoltz, and I represent the injured worker in this case, Harlan Kasubi, who is the claimant and, of course, also an appellee. The issues, I think, are three, and they divide into two areas. The first area you've basically heard from exclusively, and that is the apportionment. That issue, I don't think, applies to my client directly. But the other two issues I think do apply, or definitely apply, to my client directly. One, whether or not he is permanently and totally disabled, and two, who is responsible for the payment of certain of his medical needs. Now, to overturn the hearing examiner's decision and the decision of the circuit court, of course, you need to find that the findings of fact were clearly erroneous. You need to find that there is no way a reasonable person could have concluded as the hearing examiner did. On the issue of permanent and total disability, of course, there's two ways that my client can show he is permanently and totally disabled in a workers' compensation sense. One, to show that he has severe and debilitating pain that causes him not to be able to work. And two, if he shows that his physical condition obviously precludes him from working, then he has met his burden of proving that he is a permanent total, in permanent total disability. I think the key evidence there comes, one, from Mr. Kasubi. He, of course, testified to the hearing examiner, and the hearing examiner made a specific finding that he was a credible witness. He testified that basically these injuries all taken together had destroyed his life, and he was not able to work in virtually any sense, let alone a manner that would cause him to be able to make a reasonable wage. The other area of evidence comes from his treating physician, Dr. Lawler, who treated him up to the time of the hearing over a period of a year or two. Dr. Lawler's quotes are that he does not see that Mr. Kasubi is going to be able to work. Mr. Kasubi is medically incapable of working. His neck pain and headache have made him incapable of working. And Dr. Lawler then continues to say that those opinions haven't changed as he continues to administer to Mr. Kasubi. And so I believe that met the first standard, that Mr. Kasubi was obviously in such debilitating pain that he's not able to be gainfully employed. But the other way Mr. Kasubi met his burden was to call a vocational expert. And that vocational expert testified that it would be futile for Mr. Kasubi to enter the job market with an expectation that he would find a job that he was employable in. The only one employer really brought any evidence forward, that's Triple R Construction, that perhaps there were things that a vocational expert could testify to that might be helpful to show that he was not permanently and totally disabled. But their vocational expert did not investigate the job market, agreed that Dr. Lawler's opinions that Mr. Kasubi was medically incapable of working should not be disagreed with. And so I'm arguing, in a sense, even the employer's vocational expert indicated that Mr. Kasubi is permanently and totally disabled. The other issue is one of medical payments. I don't think there's any evidence that any of the injuries of one were not caused by work-related activity. All evidence points that all of Mr. Kasubi's injuries that there are bills for that we tried to get paid are from work-related injuries. There was medical testimony given through medical records that indicated where those various injuries were. The only question was what treatment should be paid for by what employer, given what employer was employing Mr. Kasubi at the time of that injury. There again, I think it's clear that Triple R is responsible for the injuries to the lower back, and as the hearing examiner and the circuit judge indicated, Triple R should be responsible for all injuries that are all medical treatment that is caused by injuries to the lower back. Estes Brothers has been held responsible for the injuries to the upper back and to the neck in a permanent total disability sense, and so it only makes sense that they too should be held responsible and made to pay for any medical treatment necessitated by injuries to the upper back and the neck. And so in short, I think there is clearly substantial evidence to support the decision of the department and the review that was made by the circuit judge. Clearly, I don't believe a mistake was made by either the Department of Labor or the circuit judge in their findings of fact. And so I would ask that you affirm the issue of permanent total disability and also affirm the fact that all medical treatment should be paid by one or the other of the employers that caused that injury, and that treatment is medically necessary.
Thank you. No one's ever chastised for quitting early.
All right, I'll quit early then. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Summer, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Again, I'm Scott Sumner. I represent the third-party defendant, I guess we'll call it in this case, Dean Kurtz Construction and American States Insurance Company as its workers' comp insurer. It's important to note that the claimant has not filed a claim against my client, Dean Kurtz Construction, in connection with the claims here presented. Mr. Morgans tends to want to blur over his arguments as respects my client and the alleged injury incidents that he refers to, the rib injury in July of 1996, and then the fall in the snow the following January, I think, or February it was. In the third party petition, only the rib incident is alleged as a basis for a claim against my client. The claimant amended his petition for hearing subsequent to the third-party petition, and yet did not plead over against my client. The claimant's testimony very clearly is that he did not sustain an injury in the course and scope of his employment with my client, Dean Kurtz Construction, that contributed in any way to the symptomatology that forms the basis for his claim for permanent total disability. I've argued to no avail to this point that because this is a dispute solely between Mr. Morgan's client and employer and insurer and my client, employer and insurer, that there is no jurisdiction in the Department of Labor and hence no jurisdiction for this appeal. But that seems to have fallen on deaf ears at this point. But factually, there is no factual basis for Mr. Morgan's claims. And he argues for the weakness of the claims evidence against his client, medical evidence, but the medical evidence against my client is even weaker. Involved, just say very specifically, that medical opinion testimony is required to establish what he is seeking to establish, and no medical opinion evidence was offered.
Your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Sommer. Mr. Mertens, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the independent contribution from Triple R's low back injury, if I could. The Department of Labor determined, as a finding of fact, that the low back injury is a major contributing cause to the disability. I find that to be a finding of fact which would fall under the clearly erroneous standard, and there's substantial evidence in the record to establish that there is some independent contribution, not only slight contribution, but quite a bit of contribution from this low back injury. And I'm not up here telling you that that this neck injury is still the responsibility of Estes Brothers, that that doesn't provide some contribution. But that's not what the last injurious exposure rule, how that rule is applied. It was interesting when Mr. Kasubi was deposed a second time. He was asked about how the low back affects him. He said, well, I wake up every morning with numbness and some dull ache in my shins and my feet, and with activity it gets worse. In fact, when he was being deposed, he was having those similar problems. Then it was asked, well, how often does that happen? Well, daily. And then there's questions about, well, when, what do you do? Well, sometimes I usually have to lay down a couple hours each day because of, and this is talking about the low back. There, he also testified to approximately 15 instances over a two-year time frame between the 1998 injury and the time he was deposed the second time, where he had debilitating back pain that caused him to be under bed rest for a day at a time. In fact, on one occasion, I think he testified that he was in bed for three additional days. So I don't think there's any question that Mr. Kasubi provides a basis for independent contribution for his low back injury. In addition, there's medical evidence that supports Mr. Kasubi's testimony about how this back affects him. Dr. Gruber provided testimony that the low back condition does independently contribute to his overall condition. Dr. Lawler, in his records, he was not deposed, but Dr. Lawler has separate records, and there's one record that talks about he's unable to work because of his neck. There's two separate records in that same time frame that say he's unable to work because of his neck and low back.
The crux of your argument is this, then, that you know, Consul Marcel's client should pay the whole thing, right?
Right.
And you should contribute.
Only on the, and I don't even necessarily grant that we're responsible. I don't.
All right.
It's my.
All right. And your argument rests on the fact that the record does not show that Mr. Kasubi was receiving benefits. Is that right?
That's part of it, yes, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, that's the only way that the statute can apply, you state, to show that he was receiving benefits, right?
Correct.
Now, counsel for Triple R argued that he was receiving medical benefits. Now, doesn't that fall within the statute?
The Kubel case the only case that I think in South Dakota that I'm aware of that talks about that apportionment statute, that was a medical expense case where they're disputing medical payment of medical benefits. And there, they reaffirmed that you must be disabled and drawing compensation at that time.
Well, compensation includes benefits. You know, this is a workers' compensation statute, and that includes the medical benefits, does it not?
I'm not. I think respectfully submit, Judge Sirska, that the Kubel case, in addition to all the Iowa cases that kind of go a little bit in more detail regarding this offset or apportionment statute, that there's no mention that medical benefits would mean compensation. And
are you saying compensation means, in essence, an indemnity for wages?
Exactly.
And it doesn't include medical. Now, I did note in the record that, you know, the Dr. Gruber, the chiropractor, I see there's about 20 treatments that between 5/17 and 91 and 5/2 and 97 was the last that I see of Dr. Gruber, the chiropractor. So if the word benefits or compensation includes medical benefits, then he was receiving that treatment. Do you dispute that?
Yeah, without looking back at the record, I don't think I dispute that. I'm sure that he was receiving.
I will grant you this, that most or that part of those were not due to the, you know, the Estes brother injury. So that, you know, they were due to either the fell in the snow or the rib popping or something like that. So,
and I think part of the explanation too, going back to the Smith Hart and the Celotex case in Iowa that I mentioned, helps explain why it's really talking about indemnity benefits as opposed to medical, because they're really just worried about, let's claim it cannot receive more than that 100% cap of benefits. And so there's no such limit on medical benefits, obviously, and it's really dealing with working units.
Go ahead. Well, just help me understand. Based upon your argument, I'm not clear what position you're taking as to whether the claimant is permanently and totally disabled.
We've never...
You don't dispute
that? We don't dispute that. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
We can make the statute work by adopting counsel for, counsel Marshall's argument, and we can say that, there was compensation being paid. Therefore, the apportionment is correct. You know, we can make it work that way, can't we?
If you identify medical expenses as compensation, you probably could make it work. I still think there's a question whether, and I disagree with Mrs. Marceau's argument that Mr. Kasubi was disabled at the time of this injury. Well, he had previous impairments. If we use the broad definition of disability that you've had any injury in the past, essentially.
Well, we go back to the finding of fact, though, number 21 again, and it said that it was fixed. The injuries were fixed at the time. So, you know, your injury is different than her injury.
Yes.
And so that's one way, I guess, we can make the statute work. Would you agree with that?
I think in order to make that work, you would first have to say medical benefits count as compensation. I think that's against the legal precedent, although granted that a lot of that is Iowa authority. Secondly, you'd have to establish that disability means almost anything, that if you've had any prior injury that you are considered, it says disabled and drawing compensation. Now, this guy had been working for consecutively for sure for 2 years prior to this last injury. It's hard for me to believe from a legal standpoint that he was considered disabled on November 22nd, 1990.
I see your point there.
You know, as the argument has progressed, and we're talking about some of the practical concerns, that you know, thought popped into my head as we're talking about the difference between apportionment and last injurious exposure rule. Thinking of the practical considerations of trying to, in a case like this, go take a medical deposition and go through the whole litany of extensive record of Mr. Kasubi, you know, with any medical doctor is going to have to look at the whole history and go through all the underlying basis and have to come up with, okay, now doctor, you know that the neck caused him to be injured on this particular day, and he has medications, he has these treatments, the low back did this, and in the low back he had debilitating pain, he was under bed rest. Okay, now doctor, what percentage are you going to say is for that low back, and what percentage is going to be for that neck? And I could see that you would open up a real can of worms going down this road, and I don't think we can do that with the legal precedent in the state, with the plain statutory language of SDCL 62-4-29. And therefore, I would respectfully request that this court reverse the circuit court's affirmance of the Department of Labor's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mertens. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. We'll have our rules hearing.